Deadlines. The German health minister warns citizens that they would be either, quote, vaccinated, cured, or dead from COVID-19 by the end of winter. The United States slaps sanctions on another company involved in the Russia-Germany Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Also ahead, a U.S. prosecutor says the three white men charged in the killing of an African-American pursued the victim solely because he was a black man. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Germany's health minister has issued a grim warning as Europe battles an upsurge in the COVID-19 pandemic. Jens Spahn says in a few months, all Germans will be either, quote, vaccinated, cured, or dead. This comes as the country recorded more than 30,000 new daily cases on Monday. The US has advised against travel to Denmark and Germany, where hospitals say their ICUs are almost full. The surge in cases has prompted new restrictions, with Austria becoming the first Western European nation to reimpose a full lockdown. The restrictions have sparked angry protests, which have turned violent in the Netherlands and Belgium. Europe's return to the pandemic's epicenter has been blamed on the winter season, sluggish vaccination campaigns, and the highly contagious Delta variant.
Coronavirus restrictions are returning to Europe as the governments struggle to tackle the resurgence of the pandemic. The measures have sparked protests in several European countries. Cities across the Netherlands saw fiery riots erupt for a second night, with angry mobs running amok in The Hague. Hooded protesters torched bicycles on Saturday night and threw stones and fireworks at police. Officers, some on horseback, responded by charging on the crowd and making arrests. But the rally in the capital Amsterdam remained largely peaceful amid a heavy police presence. During the first night of the unrest in the port city of Rotterdam, police opened fire on protesters, injuring a few and rounded up dozens. The Netherlands has imposed a three-week partial lockdown after registering a record spike in COVID cases. The government is also planning to ban unvaccinated people from entering public places, but the opponents argue that such restrictions are not the answer.
I expect from our leaders to have a long-term vision. We don't see a long-term vision, we just see repeating the same measures over and over again and not working.
Also in Austria, a 20-day nationwide lockdown and a plan to make jabs mandatory have brought tens of thousands to the streets of Vienna. Austria is the first European country to make vaccination a legal requirement, but the protesters believe the government is only restricting their freedom. Croatians, frustrated by COVID measures, marched through the capital Zagreb in their thousands to tell the government enough is enough. Refusing to wear protective masks, the protesters called for the government to scrap compulsory vaccinations for public sector workers.
I came to support all the people who oppose COVID passports because it's actually a measure that divides us into citizens and non-citizens, and it leads to great discrimination even towards totalitarianism.
I think that our government is doing the same thing countries that collaborated with Nazi Germany did in the 1940s.
The COVID pass for civil servants also enraged thousands of Danes who came out in Copenhagen to call on the government to cancel the measure. The World Health Organization is warning that Europe is the only region in the world with surging deaths and that the virus could kill 500,000 more people by February. 70 million infections, 1.6 million deaths, and still counting. For now, it seems that governments across Europe are facing the double dilemma of keeping the protests in check and bringing the fresh wave of infections under control.
The US imposes fresh sanctions on a company involved in the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which runs from Russia to Europe. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, announced these sanctions, which target a Cyprus-based company in connection with the project. Blinken said Washington will continue to work with Germany and its other allies to reduce what he called the risks posed by the pipeline to Ukraine and NATO. Germany earlier said it would insist that Russia keep gas flowing through its neighboring Ukraine. Nord Stream 2 has been a bone of contention between the United States and Russia, with Washington opposing to the $11 billion pipeline, which runs under the Baltic Sea. A prosecutor for the trial of three white men charged with murdering an African-American man last year says the victim was trapped and under attack. Linda Dinoski has disputed the three men's argument that they suspected Ahmed Arbery was a burglar on the run. She says the defendants are yet to provide a valid justification for chasing and attempting to place the 25-year-old under citizen's arrest. On February 23rd last year, the white men fatally shot an unarmed Arbery in a coastal Georgia suburb. The prosecutor says the victim was targeted only because he was a black man jogging down the street. Several instances of racially charged attacks against African Americans triggered nationwide demonstrations last year. Political commentator John Parker says the excuses given by the defendants in the Arbery murder trial are quite absurd, and that the victim was targeted just because he was black.
Yes, it's happening often, and as it used to happen, now it's getting more publicized because of cell phones and things. But we see it's getting more and more absurd, the excuses and the trials, and he had been jogging often. This was a kind of a routine, and there's a big difference between jogging and running, and it's very easy to see unless you're looking to find target black individuals. So there was nothing he was doing that was out of the ordinary, and he was just targeted just for being black, and they probably didn't want him in their neighborhood. And the words that they used, the expletives that they used after they shot him, shows the racist intent. But this system has a relationship with white supremacist organizations. And this system, which is in decline, this capitalist system in decline, needs those shock troops. And they need those extrajudicial types of organizations that can do things that they can't officially do. And that's what this whole right-wing fascist movement that's coming up is partly, it's almost like a paramilitary arm of the government, an unofficial arm of the government.
Saudi-backed forces are conducting airstrikes in Yemen's capital Sana'a. Explosions have reportedly rocked the northern neighborhoods of the city. For this breaking news item, let's cross over to the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, bring in our correspondent, Abdul Latif al-Washali. Abdul Latif, what's the latest?
Thank you so much, Wissam. Actually, yes, the Saudi-led coalition's war planes have conducted three airstrikes against Hayy al-A'nab. It's a civilian area. There are no casualties reported until the moment, but the targets were civilian and the houses for civilians. This attack comes in response, as experts he believe that it comes in response to the latest statements of the UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Yemen, David Grizzly. He had a visit to Sana'a Airport with the Yemeni Minister of Transport, and he said that the airport is ready and the United Nations and all the other parties have to push or put more pressure on Saudi Arabia to force this regime to open Sana'a Airport, as thousands or tens of thousands of Yemeni patients need this airport to be reopened to get the chance to travel abroad for treatment. The closing of the airport is contributing to worsening the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. So the Saudi-led coalition's war planes have came back to the Yemeni capital Sana'a and hit civilian targets, and they may hit other targets during the few coming hours.
You know, one thing, Abdul Latif, is that we know the Yemeni forces are making massive advances in Ma'rib and liberating a lot of territory there, one of the last Saudi strongholds in Yemen, in northern Yemen. And at the same time, we're seeing this campaign over the past few days, over the past week, we can say, of large-scale Saudi Arabian warplanes targeting many provinces in Yemen. Is this some form of anger? Because we know most of the Saudi warplanes, the airstrikes, they target residential neighborhoods, and it's the civilians that are killed.
Yes, the Yemeni army is making huge advances in Hudaydah, in Marib, and all the other battle fronts. Saudi Arabia has come to realize that it has failed in using the air force in forcing the Yemeni army, or at least maintaining the Yemeni army at a specific point. They failed to use the air force in the battles with the Yemeni army. So they are now just hitting civilian targets, airports, or any other targets. They said 2 days ago that the Sana'a International Airport is being used by the Yemeni army for military purposes. They are just trying to justify their brutal war and justify the air strikes against the Sana'a International Airport, which is a civilian facility used by only at these days by the United Nations and the planes of the international body. So the officials of the United Nations have seen the airport that it's not being used for any military purposes. It's being only for the flights of the United Nations, and this is an ironic situation, as they have to make these statements clear in front of the media outlets and in front of the world that this airport is civilian, being used only by civilians and only by the United Nations flights nowadays. The Saudi warplanes are hitting only civilian targets. They're not making any progress when it comes to battlefronts.
Abdul Latif, thank you very much indeed. Abdul Latif Al-Washali is our correspondent, joining us live for that breaking news story from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a itself. Now, moving on, employees working at Italian ports say the government continues its arms export to Saudi Arabia despite Rome having banned the sale of weapons to Riyadh earlier this year. The ban on arms exports to Saudi Arabia was introduced over the kingdom's involvement in the war on Yemen that has left tens of thousands of Yemenis killed. Max Civili reports from Italy.
Dockers from the Autonomous Port Workers Collective Union, or CALP, say ships carrying cargoes of tanks, helicopters, and other weapons are continued to be sent to Saudi Arabia from Italian ports in breach of local laws and the country's constitution. In January this year, Rome introduced a ban on arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates due to their involvement in the war on Yemen, where tens of thousands of civilians have been killed so far. In June, however, some of the restrictions were eased after Abu Dhabi threatened to evict Italian aircraft and personnel from a key military base in retaliation for the arms embargo. Dockers say U.S.-built tanks bound for Riyadh have recently transited through the port of Genoa.
The latest shipment of weapons arrived at the Genoa port about 2 weeks ago. There were 12 third-generation M1 Abrams tanks, as many transport and combat helicopters, and several containers full of missiles, warheads destined for Saudi Arabia. Every 20-25 days, a new shipment of weapons docks at the Genoa port.
According to the CALP Dockers Union, the ban on arms sales produced in Italy on Riyadh and Abu Dhabi is circumvented by disassembling the weapons and sending the pieces separately. Dockers Unions and the Weapon Watch, which is an independent observatory on arms transfers through Italian ports, say each time new shipments of weapons reaches Genoa, they inform the port authorities, but no action is taken.
There are two things we demand to know about the shipments: the kind of weapons they include and how dangerous these weapons are for the dockers and the people who live in the surroundings of the port. We don't want rules to be waived for partners or allies in the name of people's safety.
CALP dockers have said a new anti-militaristic internationalist movement is growing, with port workers from several cities across the world ready to join forces. Unions are working on organizing an international strike against arms exports towards countries involved in the war in mid-December.
A new shipment of weapons is scheduled for loading on a Saudi cargo at the port of Genoa this weekend. Dockers will be staging a protest with hundreds of people marching to the port to support them. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran says the West is seeking to criminalize grassroots support for the Palestinians' cause, and blacklisting resistance movements is their means to achieve this goal. In a tweet, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman described the banning of anti-Israeli resistance groups as phony designations. Saeed Khatibzadeh, however, noted that such measures don't just target groups that resist Israeli apartheid. He noted that civil societies in the countries hosting the resistance groups are the primary targets of such labeling. The remarks come days after the UK prescribed the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas as a terrorist organization in its entirety. The designation has drawn criticism inside the Palestinian territories and beyond. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran's president Said Ebrahim Raisi says the Islamic Republic is absolutely serious in its pursuit of the removal of all U.S. illegal and cruel sanctions in the talks slated to be held later this month in Austria's capital Vienna on the fate of the troubled 2015 multilateral nuclear deal. We now present you an article written by Ali Reza Karimi under the heading Why Iran Has the Right to be Strict in Vienna Talks. On 8th of May 2018, the world media broadcast a picture of then-US President Donald Trump signing an executive order, a decree that ended US's partnership in the nuclear deal between Iran and the 5+1 group of countries, the United Nations Security Council's five permanent members plus Germany. The agreement, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, had previously been considered by many countries and even by the Americans themselves the outcome of success of multilateralism in international relations. But U.S. President at the time Donald Trump annulled it with the stroke of a pen. Much of Iran's benefits in the accord were enshrined under U.S. commitments, but Iranians have always stressed that they were not properly implemented, even when the United States was a party to the JCPOA. However, the story of U.S. withdrawal from JCPOA did not end there. In addition to the restoration of previous sanctions and all-out expansion of restrictive measures under various labels, Washington blocked all parties that were seeking to implement UN Security Council Resolution 2231 by adhering to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Therefore, the United States demonstrated that it does not honor even a UN Security Council resolution which it had once voted for. On the other hand, the three European signatories to the JCPOA, France, Germany, and Britain, were unable or unwilling to take an effective action to fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA following the US pullout. Thus, their financial mechanism to engage with Iran, called INSTEX, did not work in practice. Nevertheless, Iran fully fulfilled its commitments under the JCPOA for a year after the US withdrawal from the agreement. Former U.S. President Donald Trump signed the executive order to withdraw from the JCPOA while, according to all International Atomic Energy Agency reports, Iran had fulfilled its obligations to the full and was under the strictest nuclear inspection and transparency regime. Tehran pursued the same path for a year after the U.S. pullout from the JCPOA, and again the IAEA reports confirmed again and again Iran's adherence to the agreement. During his election campaign, Donald Trump had called the JCPOA the worst deal in American history. Meanwhile, his friends in West Asia encouraged him to scrap the nuclear agreement with Iran, including Benjamin Netanyahu in the occupied Palestinian territories and Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. They, along with hardline U.S. senators such as Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton, who had undeniable anti-Iranian views, and John Bolton, a former U.S. National Security Advisor who later turned into Donald Trump's serious critic, paved the way for the United States to turn its back on its international commitments. Although the JCPOA was criticized by some politicians in Iran from the beginning for its imbalance of input and output, as well as its approach with regards to trusting the United States as a long-time enemy of the Islamic Revolution, the deal was respected and implemented as a decision of the then administration, and Tehran did not renounce it. Finally, 1 year after America's withdrawal, Iran began to reduce its nuclear commitments under the JCPOA. In Iran, a serious question on the minds of many people is, why is the country still honoring the deal, despite the U.S. pullout and the strict reimposition of sanctions, which have led to economic problems and the suffering of the nation? However, the Americans may not be aware that this reduction of commitments was precisely based on an article of the same agreement, i.e. Article 37. The article, approved by the UN Security Council as part of an annex to Resolution 2231, states, should sanctions be reimposed fully or partially, Iran will regard this as a ground for suspending all or part of its obligations under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Accordingly, Iran's right to reduce its commitments under the agreement has been recognized and approved by the UN Security Council in the event that sanctions are reimposed. The same declaration is also mentioned in Article 26 of the JCPOA itself. Thus, the picture projected by US officials concerning the violation of the JCPOA is unrealistic. With the suspension of Iran's nuclear commitments, which took place gradually and in several steps, a series of developments in the United States eventually put a controversial end to Donald Trump's administration and brought Joe Biden to power. Joe Biden, who was himself the vice president under the government that had signed the JCPOA with Iran, called for a return to the accord. However, soon the Biden administration showed that it was in no hurry to do so, and that a return to its commitments under the UN Security Council Resolution 2231 was essentially not a priority. As a result, Donald Trump's illegal and cruel sanctions against Iran have continued to this day. Negotiations were held between Iran and the 4+1 group, the remaining parties to the JCPOA, as the U.S. presence to review the resumption of the U.S. membership in the agreement. The talks continued for 6 rounds, but in practice they did not result in a U.S. return to the nuclear deal, as Washington refused to remove all sanctions imposed on Iran or to give the country a chance to verify the sanctions removal. With the elections in Iran and the government of President Said Ebrahim Raisi taking office, the Vienna talks were suspended for a short time and are scheduled to resume on 29th of November 2021. But what approach would Iran enter these negotiations with? Recently, the Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said the main goal pursued by Iran during the forthcoming talks with the remaining parties to the JCPOA is that Iran wants to secure removal of all illegal sanctions imposed on the country. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a recent phone call with his Polish counterpart Zbigniew Rau, during which the two sides discussed bilateral relations as well as regional and international developments. During the phone call, Iran's top diplomat stressed the main goal pursued by Tehran through participation in the forthcoming talks in Vienna, Austria, is removal of all illegal sanctions imposed on Iran by the United States after the latter withdrew from the agreement in 2018. Hossein Amir Abdollahian added, "All participants in Vienna talks have reached a common understanding that the United States is the main party to blame and is responsible for the current state of negotiations." After withdrawal from JCPOA, former U.S. President Donald Trump launched a maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic, which he claimed was aimed at compelling Iran into negotiating a new deal. In the latest developments surrounding this issue, Washington's Persian Gulf allies, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates welcomed the upcoming 7th round of Vienna talks and even called for an urgent mutual return to full compliance with the JCPOA, despite the fact that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, in addition to the Israeli regime, had cheered Donald Trump's withdrawal from the nuclear deal and his maximum pressure policy against Iran. Furthermore, Iran's president, Said Ebrahim Raisi, says the Islamic Republic is absolutely serious in its pursuit of the removal of all U.S. sanctions in the talks slated to be held later this month in Vienna, Austria. In a phone call on Tuesday, 16th of November, with Russian President Vladimir Putin, whose country is also a party to the agreement, the Iranian president, Said Ebrahim Raisi, praised Moscow's position in defense of Iran's nuclear rights and the necessity of the removal of all sanctions imposed on the Islamic Republic by the United States. Said Ebrahim Raisi said, "The Islamic Republic of Iran is absolutely serious in the negotiations, and we are equally serious in ensuring the right of our nation to have the sanctions removed." It is almost clear that Iran's main purpose in participating in the talks is to remove all illegal U.S. sanctions, which have caused the suffering of the Iranian people. The Iranian government feels responsible to act if there is a possibility to remove the sanctions under fair conditions. On the other hand, Iran has repeatedly stressed that it is ready to return to its full obligations under the JCPOA whenever other parties meet their commitments and the sanctions removal is verified. However, Iran's experience shows that it cannot negotiate with a lenient approach towards the Americans. Washington easily violated UN Security Council Resolution 2231, reinstated and expanded sanctions against Iran, and even blocked Iran's access to medicine and food. Additionally, it carried out terrorist acts against Iran and martyred a senior Iranian military commander on the soil of a third country. Naturally, without verification and receiving necessary guarantees, no agreement can be reached with a country that has such a history. This is while the US Republicans are vowing that they will once again violate the deal if they take helm of the US executive branch of government. Moreover, the possibility of Donald Trump's return to power has become serious, given Joe Biden's poor performance and especially the debacle of US withdrawal from Afghanistan. The question is, if Western politicians wanted to decide in a similar situation, would they be open to a new agreement and scaling back their nuclear programs without a guarantee? The answer to this question seems evident.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and let us reflect on an aphorism bequeathed to us for our guidance from Imam Hassan Askari, peace be upon him, the 11th infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. There are two qualities such that there is no quality above them: faith in Allah and the serving of brothers.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir la'in ar-rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Previously, we were looking at human rights from the eyes and perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salamullah. And we shall continue looking at this topic through his perspective. Among the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he gave high priority to is the right of family and the right of marriage and the right of childhood. Now, we do understand that among the most simple, basic fundamentals of rights is on the person is the right to create a family. For Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he considers it to be the basic, the foundation of any society, of any civilization. So Islam came and he put the foundation and laid the rules to creating a strong family and gave it its rights and gave it protection. Because through the successful family, we have a successful society. Through a successful society, we have a successful country, and we have a successful world. So the entire universe, or at least let's say the entire earth itself, consists of people who live amongst each other, be it in nations, be it in tribes, be it in small communities. And the basic and the first brick that we have to lay is the family itself. So it consists of that family. So the Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam and Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, first and foremost, they put a great emphasis on the relationship between two partners. And they considered this you know, the link between the strength of the community, the strength of the society, the strength of the ummah, and the relationship itself. So if this relationship continues, then so would society. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he considers getting married, creating a family, having children, is a natural right of every human being. And he was dealing with this issue from a realistic perspective by identifying the problems and by identifying where things could go wrong and what is necessary for the continuation of humanity itself. Beginning with trying to touch on the human sexual desire itself, because sometimes it is the cause of corruption, and sometimes it is a distraction of society, distraction of families, distraction of relationship itself between two partners. If this not being dealt with in a proper manner, this sexual relationship of a person, or his desire to have his sexual needs met, if they are not dealt with in a correct manner, it would turn the human being into an animalistic person, or at least he will be an animal in the real sense of the word, that will create and cause corruption on earth. Unless that is met and that is being dealt with, things will go wrong. So we can see even through the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, when he talks to people when it comes to the matter of their sexual desire, he says it needs to be controlled, it needs to be maintained, it needs to be at least put in a way where it's only used in the correct manner. Now, there's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi where he talks to specifically men in this regard, because sometimes we are blaming women for everything, but Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he says it's an equal responsibility when it comes to men and women, when it comes to controlling their desires and not letting it run wild that causes corruption and problems in community, or at least in the family to begin with. Let us take a short break and then inshallah we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from RIB English Radio. Just before the break, we were saying Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam was talking to men about controlling their sexual desires in order to have a safer family, safer relationship, and a safer community in return. So he says, إِيَّاكَ وَكَثْرَةِ الْوَلَهِ بِالنِّسَاءِ. I warn you and not to dive too deep any desires in women. والإغراء باللذات, and do not indulge yourself too much in desires. فإن الوله بالنساء والمغراء باللذات ممتهن. For he who indulges too much in women and too much in desires, he will be humiliated. So such a person who lives on this line where he only wants to meet his desires, he is not a valued member of society. He's not going to contribute to society because all that he cares about is himself. If he's satisfied, if he has what he needs, then he's okay. If he's not, then he will go around creating problems for the community and for the society and for the entire nation together. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he comes and looks at marriage as a constitution, he looks at it as a holy constitution that needs to be respected, and he lays the foundation to this constitution itself. Now, what we need to understand is that the societies that we live in and the oppressors and the tyrants of each society, the causes of their tyranny, the causes of their oppression, usually stems from personal moral, corrupted moral vices. When these people themselves are corrupted when it comes to their desires and their vices, obviously they will take that onto people. Even Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he looks at, for example, the social level or political level, he says it gets destroyed because people become, as he uses the word, the urban wasalatina. They become nothing but wolves and tyrants. And then he talks about how they eat the wealth and the money of those who are poor, and they take it by power. And they use, whether it is lying, whether it is, you know, fighting with people, and they just use all these kind of methods to take the rights of other people. So he says from here, unless a person, first and foremost, gets to control himself and maintains his morals and values, then he is a threat to society itself. From here, he comes and lays the foundation that these people, because they have that desire, because they're human beings, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has embedded such a thing into them, it's a thing that they cannot deny, a thing they cannot get rid of. Rather, they have to deal with it in the correct manner. From here, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa ala and Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam and all other imams and even the Quran, they laid the foundation to starting a prosperous, happy relationship and a happy family. And that is the right of every human being. This is not limited to the elite. This is not limited to a specific level of community or a level of the society. This should be the right of everybody. If that's maintained, if that's covered, then we should have a prosperous, happier society. Inshallah, we'll continue this topic in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم أرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
The Light.
Space lovers have been treated to an epic lunar eclipse that dazzled the night skies of the Northern Hemisphere. The event is also known as the Blood Moon because of the red haze seen around the moon during the eclipse. The 3.5-hour phenomenon gave stargazers the chance to witness the longest partial eclipse in 580 years. Although NASA calls this celestial event a partial eclipse, around 97% of the moon was cast into a red hue by the Earth's shadow. A total eclipse could also be seen in Russia's far eastern regions. The next longest partial eclipse will take place in around 648 years.
An 11-month-old baby has become an internet sensation after a video of her snowboarding went viral in China. Wang Yuji is a daredevil infant snowboarder whose adorable face sticks out underneath all the protective snow and sports gear. Her parents decided to learn skiing during the winter, but they also wanted to include their baby on the fun of snow sports. While snowboarding might be a bit too early for a toddler who can barely stand or walk, Yuji was not scared at all and even enjoyed it. China, which is hosting the Winter Olympics in a couple of months, is encouraging citizens to try ice and snow sports.
Every year, the roads across this tiny island in northwestern Australia turn scarlet just as millions of crabs leave their homes in the depths of the forest and start marching together all the way to the ocean where they can mate and spawn. The spectacular group voyage on Christmas Island happens after the first rainfall in October or November. And in order to give these red creatures the leeway, locals close off multiple roads across the island. They've even built a special bridge for the crabs so that they can cross the road unharmed. The mesmerizing migration is now a tourist attraction, drawing nature lovers from around the globe.
Paleontologists in Brazil have discovered remains that could belong to a species of dinosaur as yet unknown. The fossils were found at a site in northeastern Brazil. A team of scientists is trying to put together the bones and complete the huge dinosaur's skeleton. They think it lived during the Cretaceous period, which began around 145 million years ago and ended with extinction of all dinosaurs roughly 66 million years ago.
A new study shows that moderate consumption of tea and coffee may be better for your health than previously thought. The study conducted by a Chinese medical university says tea and coffee can help keep stroke and dementia at bay. And if you're wondering what is meant by moderate consumption, it's defined as something between 2 and 5 cups of tea and coffee, either alone or combined in one day. The study followed more than 360,000 people aged 50 to 74 for over a decade. Some scientists have praised the study as robust. Others, however, say the participants were all selected from the UK Biobank, which means they're healthier than the general population. Pomegranate has a special place in Iranian culture. There is a trace of the fruit everywhere from poetry to cooking. Iranians even hold a pomegranate festival in the fall. This year the event is held in one of the main parks in the capital, Tehran. The festival features different varieties of pomegranates that are grown across Iran. The visitors can also find pomegranate products, including juices, concentrates, and dressings. The event includes cultural parades, music concerts, and traditional live performances. Iranians say they always welcome the pomegranate season, as it's one of the old symbols in the country's literature and art. The Christmas season always brings happiness and joy to people around the world. Many Parisians these days are taking a respite from their daily routines and hitting famous departmental stores now light up with present boxes. Cheerful families could be spotted at Christmas-decorated galleries, Lafayette and Printemps department stores. Automated figures and colorful window displays are the center of attractions for them and their children. It's a season when people buy Christmas gifts for their loved ones and stores make big profits this time around. Many Parisians say they want to take advantage of this period as the government is debating whether or not to impose a COVID-related lockdown. In Venezuela, a large number of musicians are striving for one common goal, and that's setting the Guinness record as the world's largest orchestra. Over 12,000 musicians, mostly children and adolescents, have played together to make that happen. Hundreds of violins, violas, and double basses playing in unison at this setting in Caracas. The musicians are all connected to the country's network of youth orchestras. For them to set a record, over 8,000 instruments had to play at the same time during a 5-minute period of a classical piece. Right now, a Russian orchestra that played the country's national anthem is holding the record. Once done, the crowd of musicians erupted in cheers, lifting their instruments and waving Venezuelan flags. Guinness will announce its decision in the next 10 days. Tourists and residents in Los Angeles have been mesmerized by a dazzling new event the U.S. city is hosting, with holiday-themed and full of colorful lights. Visitors can enjoy a mile-long walkway covered on all sides with brightly lit installations. Artists from around the world have taken part in the exhibition. The centerpiece display is a cathedral tunnel lit with thousands of bulbs. Another amazing attraction is the orbs, lit up with thousands of torches. The event has been a huge hit with the LA public.
Oh my gosh, it's so nice.
And it gets to be out in the open, and it's like a perfect night to do it, so it's great.
It's definitely the best. Like, we had to do, like, in a car to go see lights, and then we got to, like, now, like, go around and actually walk and get to see everything up close, which is super nice.
Yeah.
Definitely after the, year and a half that we've had.
Yeah.
So.
And it's really nice to see everything up close, because it's, like, you see in a photo, but then it's more real and real, so.
Yeah.
The event opened to the public on the 12th of November and will run for 5 nights. Preparations for the event, however, started a month ago. The organizers say millions of bulbs and 17 miles of cables are used for the 18 art installations.
From a gray and gloomy look to a cheery and colorful appearance. That's the story of how a neighborhood in Peru's capital, Lima, is being transformed to become a tourist attraction. A group of artists in Lima are bringing color and joy to this hilly neighborhood by painting the walls of houses. Creating an optical illusion of a giant mural, the project is visible from different spots across the city. The designers are hoping what they did can improve the lives of residents in a neighborhood that was considered to be unsafe before.
What we are doing here is communal work with all the neighbors, and we are doing it because it's important to change the environment through the use of colors. This hill was considered an unsafe and dangerous area of the city, so we decided to change that social stigma through art, which, for me as a muralist, is the best tool to achieve it.
The project was started 5 months ago, and workers are now putting the final touches to their work of art. The mural covers over 300,000 square meters. It's the largest in South America.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
the birth of a baby sloth at an uncharacteristically hasty speed has surprised London zookeepers. A tiny two-toed sloth named Terry was born to a mother, Marilyn, at the weekend. The zookeepers say there was no sign at all that Marilyn was going into labor when they checked her in the morning. However, less than an hour, they spotted something like a tiny arm tucked into her tummy. Marilyn had quietly delivered the baby with no fuss at all while her keepers were chopping up sweet potatoes for her breakfast. The mother and baby are said to be doing well, but the zookeepers still don't know the sex of the baby.
Modern technology has changed our lives in countless ways, with robots now preparing to lend a hand in operation rooms. Surgical robots are on display at the 4th China International Import Expo. One of the machines, dubbed Mazer X, gives assistance in spinal surgery. Employing the robot can lessen bleeding by 50% compared to open surgeries. Another one assists doctors to perform interventional surgeries.
Guide valves in the vessels can be controlled even less than 1 millimeter. Yeah. This is not cannot be achieved by the human hands. With the great, I think, market impact from this showcase, we successfully performed a first case PCI in Hainan Boao on March 13th.
The producers say surgical robots will soon operate in more hospitals around China. Therefore, training centers have been established to help surgeons learn how to operate the new generation of surgical robots.
A tigress belonging to the endangered Bengal species has given birth to four cubs at the Mexican Zoo, bringing joy and hope to wildlife enthusiasts. The four were born in the San Jorge Park in the city of Ciudad Juarez on October 10th. Nearly a month on, they are in good health. That is good news, because usually when multiple cubs are born, not all of them survive. Zoo officials have not yet determined the sex of the newborn cubs. That is because their mother lets out a roar when the vets are nearby. Bengal tigers are endangered for two reasons: poaching and the destruction of their natural habitat. Classic car lovers have gone on an exciting rally to see an erupting volcano. The event, organized by Beshbok Rallies, happened on a Saturday. Motorists taking part in the vintage rally had the unique opportunity to witness a volcano erupting ash and smoke. Most of the participants tried to get as close as they could to the volcano, but there were also those who chose to take other vehicles because they were afraid that their precious antique cars would be damaged.
A group of women are joining hands to protect one of India's key natural sites that is also on UNESCO's heritage list, the Western Ghats, a mountain chain that's facing severe deforestation. The 27 members of this all-female task force are doing all they can to protect the area's rare ferns, mosses, and thousands of other plants. They're using a variety of gardening tools and techniques to preserve species from all over the mountains. Not only that, but they also make artificial conditions and habitats for endangered species from other parts of the world, mainly those affected by climate change. One of the conservationists explained that what they are doing is actually helping the forest regenerate.
We have witnessed the birth of a forest, and that's a very powerful thing. You know, the mind is filled with the ghastly stories of forests being cut, like the Amazon or like the Western Ghats. But here we're witness to the birth of forests as well. And that is the forest itself birthing itself, you see.
The Western Ghats Mountains are home to nearly 5,000 species of flowering plants, but many of them are globally threatened. Only less than half